Coming up on this week's Book Show, Bill McKibben, often referred to as America's most important environmentalist, 30 years ago offered one of the earliest warnings about climate change in his book, The End of Nature. Now he broadens the warning. The entire human game, he suggests, has begun to play itself out. His new book is Falter, Bill McKibben, on this week's Book Show. Welcome to The Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. This is an off-the-shelf edition of The Book Show in partnership with Northshire Bookstore in Manchester Center, Vermont, and recorded before a live audience. 30 years ago, Bill McKibben offered one of the earliest warnings about climate change in his book, The End of Nature. Now he broadens the warning. The entire human game, he suggests, has begun to play itself out. Even as climate change shrinks the space where our civilization can exist, new technologies like artificial intelligence and robotics threaten to bleach away the variety of human experience. Bill's new book, Falter, tells the story of these converging trends and the ideological fervor that keeps us from bringing them under control. And then, drawing on his experience in building 350.org, a global citizens' movement to combat climate change, it offers some possible ways out of the trap. The new book is Falter, and it is a great pleasure to welcome Bill McKibben to The Book Show. What a pleasure. Very nice to have you here.
Joe, as always, a pleasure to get to talk with you.
I will say that you put this really upfront in your book. You say, put simply, between ecological destruction and technological hubris, the human experiment is now in question. The stakes feel very high, and the odds very long, and the trends very ominous. So I have no doubt that there are other books that would offer readers a merrier literary experience.
This is kind of familiar ground in a sense for me. The first book I wrote when I was 27 had the cheerful title, The End of Nature. I will say that the book ends with a somewhat more hopeful note than it begins, because I do think there are ways out. But I also think that time is not our friend here. The problems that we're dealing with, maybe climate change most immediately, are timed tests, and we're not used to facing those. And so far, our societies and governments have not reacted with the nimbleness that we need.
You write, as I mentioned, the subtitle is, Has the Human Game Begun to Play Itself Out? You write, what I want to talk about is the human game. The sum total of culture and commerce and politics, of religion and sport and social life, of dance and music, of dinner and art and cancer and sex and Instagram, of love and loss, of everything that comprises the experience of our species. How is it a game?
Well, it's a game in the sense that it has no obvious end to it. There's not something to which we're aiming as a human project, you know. Like the best games, the main point is to sort of keep it going. You can play the human game better or worse. I think for me, the kind of definition would be, are we adding more dignity to more lives as we go along? But the real point is to keep it going. There's no obvious finish line to which we're headed, save the one, you know, 2 or 3 billion years in the future when the sun blows up. But that's a different order of book altogether.
You say that the source of your disquiet can be summed up in a single word, and it is a word that you repeat frequently in the book. And in fact, there's a section called it, and that is leverage.
leverage. Previously in human history, when things have gone wrong, and things go wrong at regular intervals, they've gone wrong in one place, and it hasn't threatened the entire enterprise. The Roman Empire falls, but the Aztec Empire or the Chinese dynasty barely feels the effects, if it even knows about it at all. That's no longer true. There's now going on 8 billion of us, and we're hooked together very, very tightly. And so everything we do has enormous leverage. The fact that all the world began burning fossil fuel with really serious intent 70 or 80 years ago meant that there were so many of us doing it that we've managed to, say, make the ocean 30% more acidic than it was before. Hannibal with his legions or Caesar with his empire couldn't do things like that, but we can. There's a second kind of leverage, though, that the book also tries to talk about that's even more powerful, I think. And that's that this vast collection of human beings has had at its apex a very small number of people who have had a very particular ideology, and that ideology has gotten very much in the way of doing anything about the threats we face. The last 30 or 40 years, since the Reagan era, the most powerful country in the world has been dominated by this idea at its power centers of a kind of laissez-faire, markets solve all problems, leave wealth and power alone ideology. And that's actually exactly the ideology that you don't need if you're trying to deal with a problem, a crisis like climate change. Sometimes I talk to otherwise very smart people who, over the years, who are extremely rich and powerful and things, and you can almost see the syllogism in their heads, the thing that they believe. Markets solve all problems. Markets aren't solving climate change. Therefore, climate change is not a problem, okay? It's not a very good syllogism, but it's a emotionally comforting one if you read Ayn Rand at an impressionable age and truly believed it.
You do tell a story, there's an entire chapter in the book about Exxon, and you write, there should be a word for when you commit treason against an entire planet.
So I've always tried hard not to be hyperbolic. I would not have said that 3 or 4 years ago, even though I've spent years fighting with the fossil fuel industry. Yeah, I've always known that they were the thing that was keeping us from getting done what we needed to do on climate change. But we learned over the last 3 or 4 years, thanks to great investigative reporting from the LA Times, from the Columbia Journalism School, from the Pulitzer-winning website Inside Climate News, these guys really dug in, and they, between interviewing a bunch of whistleblowers and finding a lot of old archives, they were able to demonstrate beyond any shadow of a doubt that the fossil fuel industry knew all that there was to know about climate change in the early 1980s. And if you think about it for a minute, it makes sense. Exxon was the richest company on Earth. They had great scientists, obviously, on their staff. Their product was carbon. They were going to figure out what was going on. And they did. By 1982 or 83, their scientists had told their executives how much it was going to warm and how fast. And their executives believed them. Exxon, for one, started building every drilling rig they built higher to compensate for the rise in sea level they knew was on the way. They began mapping out what parts of the Arctic they were going to bid for because they knew they would be soon to melt. What they didn't do was tell any of the rest of us. Instead, they spent billions of dollars building the architecture of deceit and denial and disinformation that kept us locked for 30 years in a completely sterile debate about whether or not global warming was real. A debate that both sides knew the answer to at the beginning. It's just that one of the sides was willing to lie. And that lie became arguably, maybe inarguably, the most consequential lie in human history, because it's cost us, if instead of wasting those three decades Think what would have happened if the day after Jim Hansen testified before Congress in 1988, think what would have happened if the CEO of Exxon had merely said, you know what, our scientists are finding the same thing, which seems like the least that any ethical or moral system would have demanded of them. No one would have said, oh, Exxon's just a bunch of climate alarmists, pay them no attention. Everyone would have said, okay, we've got a problem, we better get to work. Exxon's part of the job might well have been to invest some of their immense cash flow in developing renewable energy at a rapid pace. The rest of us would have done other things. We wouldn't have solved climate change by this point, but we'd be well on the way to solving it. Instead, we did just the opposite. We spent the 30 years careening in the opposite direction, and that means now all our options are difficult. The small shifts, modest price on carbon, that 30 years ago would have re-steered this ocean liner in an important way, now are much too small to make a difference. Now we have to do very hard things. One of the reasons that I sometimes despair is just the fact that it's going to be very hard to do those things in the short window of time we've now left ourselves.
So in this chapter, you have a line that just struck me, and I read it four times just because it is, to me, the greatest. You know, you can spend a lot of times wringing your hands and saying, oh my God, what could have happened? But you say, what is certain is that this disinformation campaign cost us the human generation that might have made the crucial difference in the climate fight. Man.
Yeah. Here's a way to say it. I almost wish I could show you the author photo from when I wrote The End of Nature 30 years ago, okay? Because I was 27, 28 when it came out, and I had a full head of hair, and I was a young man, and so on and so forth. Now I'm not, obviously. I look very different. And there's, you know, some bittersweetness to that. But that's normal and natural. That's what's supposed to happen. It would be weird if it didn't happen. What is very weird is the fact that the planet has undergone much the same sort of scale of change in that 30 years. It looks entirely different. If you take a picture of it from outer space, there's half as much ice in the summer Arctic as there, I suppose, if you think about it, it's sort of the opposite of me. There's a lot less white up top on the planet. Everything about this, you know, what was a warning then is now just the daily brutal fact of life. For someplace on Earth, there's a few million people every day who are feeling some horrible result of this. At the moment, we should keep in our minds and hearts our brothers and sisters in Malawi and Zimbabwe and Mozambique who have suffered through what they're calling the worst disaster in the history of the Southern Hemisphere. Mm. The cyclone that flooded those places a month ago is now producing cholera deaths every day. And someplace like this, it happens now all the time. Sometimes we see it because it's in a place with cameras, but most of this stuff happens in places without cameras. I mean, the iron law of climate change is the less you did to cause it, the sooner and harder you suffer from it. So it's worth keeping all that in mind, I think.
Bill McKibben is our guest. The name of the new book is Falter. Has the human game begun to play itself out? I hold in my hand a copy of The Fountainhead. You say you could argue that the most important political philosopher of our time is novelist Ayn Rand. Indeed, given the leverage of the present moment, leverage that is threatening to end the human game, you could argue she's the most important philosopher of all time.
Read the next sentence, though.
I will. She would have agreed. She once told a reporter that she was the most creative thinker alive and that the only other philosopher who'd influenced her was Aristotle.
I said she was the most important, not because I think there's much at all to her thought. I mean, truthfully.
Oh, hold on. I want to read what you say about her. Because you basically, what do you say, that she...
I think what I said was she might as well have written in crayon.
Her ideas about the world are simple-minded, one-dimensional, and poisonous.
Yeah. There's nothing complex about it. It's a very interesting story, actually. If anyone has an excuse for being the sort of hyper-libertarian, hyper-individualist that she was, it's actually her. When she was 12, her family, which was a sort of middle-class pharmacist's family in Russia, the Russian Revolution came along, and the Red Guards knocked on the door and expropriated her family's pharmacy in the name of the people. So, you know, imagine you're 12 and you watch your father humiliated and your life turned over. It's no wonder that she ended up believing what she believed. And the reason that she became so powerful historically, the reason why more powerful people cite her as their favorite author than any other, is because she wrote novels, not tracts. They're not very good novels, but they do, in a certain way, at least bring these ideas to life. For a certain kind of person, they've proved really powerful. The idea that you should only think about yourself, the idea that government is always bad. I mean, this was the idea that Reagan seized on. The idea that Margaret Thatcher put beautifully when she said, there's no such thing as a society, there's only individuals. The idea that altruism was the great trap to avoid. These are the ideas that basically explain American political life over the last 30 or 40 years. The Koch brothers are Ayn Rand characters brought to life, you know, taken together, the richest person in the world, and all of their money come from oil and gas, and much of their money spent on gaming the political system to make sure that no one would ever ask them for anything. The utter triumph of this, you know, the sort of final triumph of this line of thinking was the massive tax cut passed last year just as a gift to the richest people in the world.
Of course, it brings us to one of those characters, Howard Roark, who Donald Trump identifies with.
Donald Trump said that The Fountainhead was the greatest book ever. I think he said the greatest. He said the greatest, certainly the greatest book he'd ever read. He might have said the greatest book ever written. It is everything, he said. And one almost believed, listening to him talk about it, that he'd actually read it. And truthfully, think about it. If you've only read one or two books in your life, they're likely to be extremely powerful, you know, influences.
You do say, however, the point is, long before Donald Trump took over, the Koch's network had shut off the possibility of any serious action on climate change. And you go then into tell a story about John McCain, who we lost last year, Senator McCain. You were interviewing Senator McCain, I guess, for The New Yorker. Was it for The New Yorker?
I think so.
He was very much preaching your gospel.
Yes. 10, 15 years ago, actually, McCain was, it couldn't have been for The New Yorker, because I can see the cover of the magazine, his interview, it said Captain Planet on the thing. He was really, when he campaigned for president in 2000, young people followed him around New Hampshire, including a guy dressed in a Captain Planet suit. And every time he gave a talk, they'd stand up and say, what's your plan on climate change? And it really got in his head, and he came back to Washington and set to work on this and started introducing legislation and so on and so forth. And then he was challenged from the right by a kind of Koch brothers, really far out right wing, almost lost his Senate seat. And that was the end of that, you know. No more talk about climate change for John McCain, or indeed for anybody else in the Republican Party, not for the last 10 years. The greatest crisis that the planet has ever faced, and literally nothing has come out of Congress to even begin to address it, because the Koch brothers et al. Have made it impossible for that to happen. The real story, if you're interested, is in Jane Mayer's remarkable book, Dark Money, which I highly recommend.
So that happens, and then there's the election of Donald Trump, and then we just stop doing everything.
Anything.
And you say, if you try to figure out the worst way to respond to climate change, all of this is what it would look like. Actually, the worst possible plan would also include trying to squash action in every other country as well, and we did that too.
It's not that the Paris Climate Accord is any virtuoso, magnificent document. It's flawed and weaker than it should have been, and so on. But it did represent the first attempt by the planet to try and do something. And the fact that the country that's put more carbon into the atmosphere than any other country historically is also the only country that now is unwilling to take part at all in the global effort to solve it. There's many reasons to feel chagrin about what's happened in our country, I think, over the last couple of years, but it's hard to top that one. I mean, God knows they'll try, but it's hard to top that one.
I want to get to the happy part that you mentioned before, in the few minutes that we have left, or as happy as we can make it. But you write in here, and it's such a fascinating, I'm hoping you can just give us a distillation of it, but you write about this distinction, artificial and natural, and what we have seen in technology and what is possible of making us perfect humans and making us run fast and making our teeth straight and making it so that we don't die.
Mm.
That's the technology that we're up against.
So there's one section of the book is about the technologies coming out of Silicon Valley right now. And I write about them in part because they're the product of some of the same libertarian thinking about the world. The single notion of Silicon Valley is do not regulate us, don't get in our way. You know, as Mark Zuckerberg said at one point, our motto is move fast and break things. And boy, has he borne it out. The real reason I wrote about it was because some of these things feel to me the same way that climate change felt to me 30 years ago, as this existential threat that's now coming into focus, and that if we want to do anything about, we better do it now. For me, the place where it's sort of most obvious to see, because it's a little further along, is human genetic engineering. There's a number of Silicon Valley companies lined up behind the idea that we should be all know our genome and things. And the reason is because when you start talking to these people, because they foresee a time in the not distant future when we'll be improving our children by altering their genes in embryo. In fact, in October, the first two genetically engineered children, the first two designer babies, were born, a pair of twins in China. And there's been some reaction to that in the scientific community and some attempt to begin drawing lines, but it's going to be very hard to defend that line. And we should defend it because, A, we can take care of disease and things without crossing it. If you have a genetically transmitted disease, there are other ways to make sure that it's not passed down. But B, because once we start designing people, once we start turning people into products, we live in a very different place. There's a lot of discussion of the practical problems with that, but in the end, the thing that gets me are the questions around human meaning. And I propose a thought experiment in the book. You know, imagine that you go into the clinic, as many of these thinkers have envisioned will soon be possible, and can put down 10 grand or whatever to get whatever the set of upgrades that's currently available for your child in utero. Okay, you've perhaps changed the dopamine uptake and maybe tried to add a couple of IQ points somehow or something. And I mean, these are things that are coming into view. Now imagine you go back 5 years later and you have a little more money, and more to the point, technology has progressed the way that these technologies do. And your second child, when you sit down to design them, you can get a much better package now. What's your first kid? Your first kid is, you know, iPhone 6. Your first kid is Windows 2000.
That's why you trade it in.
Yeah. And so on forever. A feature of making people into products is their obsolescence. And another feature is that their sense of identity is shaken in the most fundamental ways. Imagine you've engineered your child such that they have a different level of serotonin to regulate their mood so that they're happier and more optimistic, something that one can imagine doing. Now imagine you're that child and you reach, I don't know, 13, and you wake up one morning kind of giddy and happy about the world and completely unsure whether it's because of something that's actually happening or whether it's just your spec kicking in, you know, your design taking over. These are steps that we should not take easily if we take them at all. And part of that means defending the idea that human beings are pretty good as they are now. That's a place that I'm willing to defend.
Let me ask you, you make the point, we started off by talking about the human game, and you say toward the end that the human game is a team sport. So how, as a team, can we work on what you have laid out for us here is the way we are faltering?
So team sport in that human solidarity, or you might call it love, up against the kind of hyper-individualism that's marked the upper reaches of our society in recent decades is the key. Human solidarity means taking advantage, I think, of one of the key technologies of the 20th century, and that technology was the invention of nonviolent movements, movement building. When we look back someday on the 20th century, I think we'll think it's far more important than nuclear power or genetic engineering or anything else, this sort of set of ideas that the suffragettes and Gandhi and King and others began to develop that allow the small and many to take on the mighty and the few with some chance of success. That's why we've started movement building so assiduously around climate change. And you can see it now starting to find, I mean, this is in some sense a very happy couple of months for me because one can see this movement flowering. One can see most of all the remarkable school strikes that Greta Thunberg, the Swedish schoolgirl, kicked off in September and that now have enrolled millions upon millions of young people all around the world. You can see the amazing work that young people are doing to push the Green New Deal in this country. The rest of us who are somewhat less young have to figure out now how to back them up. And, you know, stay tuned to places like 350.org. We're going to be asking you to do the adult equivalents of school strikes and things coming up in the months ahead, because our job literally is to figure out how to disrupt business as usual, because literally it is business as usual that's doing us in. Just the fact that we get up every morning and do the things we're supposed to do without figuring out how to take note of the fact that the worst thing that's ever happened on the planet is happening. That's got to stop, and it can stop because there's enough of us if we manage to knit ourselves together.
Bill McKibben's new book is Falter, Has the Human Game Begun to Play Itself Out? The book is published by Henry Holt. Bill McKibben, it's always a great pleasure. Thank you so much.
Joe, thank you so much for your good work as always.
We enjoy hearing from our listeners about the show. You can email us at book@wamc.org, and you can listen again to this or find past book shows at wamc.org. This off-the-shelf edition was recorded in Manchester Center, Vermont, in partnership with the Northshire Bookstore, northshire.com. Bookmark us for next week, and thanks for listening. For The Book Show, I'm Joe Donahue.